Well, because as a freelance journalist, I have been very interested in how cities are made and unmade. I live and write from Detroit. It's been a very interesting decade, to say the least. And I've been very interested in the, you know, what makes cities vulnerable in the first place, and how does that affect the well-being of the people who live in them? Naturally, this drew me to Flint, which has a lot of the similar issues going on there. When this water crisis was beginning to break open, I had the opportunity to do a number of articles about it for various national publications, and that ultimately led to the opportunity to do a deeper dive with this book.
There's a jumping off point. There's this start date that everybody associates with in Michigan, that the crisis began in 2014.
Right, with this really infamous press conference, right, at the city water plant. There's this video where you can see the mayor, the city council members, the emergency manager, officials with the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. They're all there doing a countdown to turn off the water from Detroit that had been serving Flint for about 50 years. And they do a toast with this river water that they're going to use as for drinking water for the next few years, they believe. Of course, things did not go as smoothly as they had hoped, and we've come to reckon with a number of issues with the drinking water system that are really going to be playing out for generations to come in Flint. But one thing I really wanted to do with the book was to make the case that April 2014 isn't really where this crisis started. I'm really interested in how the decisions made in the decades past that set Flint up to fail in so many ways, you know? I mean, this is a city that back in the 60s, they had 200,000 people. They had all these huge General Motors plants. They hooked onto the Detroit system in the first place because they believed they were going to only grow. They were going to continue to grow, and they wanted to be served from Lake Huron as its drinking water source because that seemed, you know, just limitless. You know, it could support all that future development. What it didn't know is that it had peaked. By 1970, Flint registered its first downtick in population with the census that has continued to this day. And of course, a number of businesses and other institutions have also exited the city. But the infrastructure didn't shrink along with the population. So you have far fewer ratepayers supporting a very large drinking water system. You can imagine that results in very expensive bills, a lot of, you know, deferred maintenance. Flint is losing about 50% of its water through leaks. The water crisis before the water crisis in Flint was just how expensive these bills were, especially when the community was disproportionately poor. It was a huge burden and really helped build the momentum for a change in the community.
What happens to the people of Flint when you start to see business move out? Is there white flight? What happens?
I mean, it's absolutely white flight. Yeah, I mean, this that downtick in population starting in 1970, that's immediately after all our civil rights laws and triumphs, right? You know, fair housing, school desegregation. When people who still believed in the separate but equal way of living lost those battles, they decided to just kind of start over in new communities. And they were supported with this. They're incentivized to do this through, you know, federal lending policies for home mortgages, insurance policies. We had the highway system being built up, you know, shopping malls in the suburbs that were pulling resources that might have otherwise gone to core city downtowns. There's a lot of reasons to move out, not all of them very noble. I think this is something we haven't really reckoned with, you know. Flint in particular, it was literally the most segregated city in the north and the third most segregated city nationwide at a certain point. There were only two neighborhoods where African Americans were allowed to live. As their population was growing because of all those jobs that were enticing people to the city, both white people and black people, that was resulting in just more and more tense conditions, you know? And once, you know, fair housing was won in Flint and nationwide, you know, a lot of people just decided they'd rather move outside and be commuting into the city. And after a while, not even that.
So you have the infrastructure deteriorating. You don't have the number of people there to support it financially. Cut to 2014 and beyond. You're reporting on this. What do you begin to see?
Well, right. So Flint decided it was going to leave the Detroit water system. It was going to join a brand new water system. And this water system wasn't even built yet. So they were going to temporarily treat Flint River water at its own rebooted city plant. The problems were that the plant did not receive the upgrades it needed to treat river water appropriately. River water is just anywhere. It's just going to be more complex than lake water. And most significantly, this water wasn't treated with something called corrosion control, which is what you need to add to drinking water so that when it passes through the water lines and service lines, those pipes don't corrode and contaminate the water by the time it reaches our taps. And that's especially significant because we have lead service lines all over the country in poor and wealthy cities, and they are dangerous. They are actually dangerous. It's something we've really got to deal with. And in Flint, it really became a disaster because those pipes were corroding at such a significant rate. The lead problem in Flint wasn't really known for almost a year after the switch, but there were a number of other issues. You know, the water smelled bad. It felt bad. It tasted strange. You know, it was beginning as iron was corroding from the water system. The water looked orange or brown in certain areas. There was boil water advisories for these E. coli bacteria problems. There was a carcinogenic byproduct that showed up from over-chlorinating the water. There was a number of problems to alarm residents, and they did everything they were supposed to do. They showed up at public meetings. They were calling the local officials, the state officials, the EPA even, registering complaints with the water, asking questions, doing some of their own investigations, trying to map out where water problems were in their city so they could kind of understand what was going on, taking their children to the doctors, trying to find out if there's consequences from this. But these did not register for a year and a half after the water switch.
If you are maintaining a water system, I would think that you would know the difference between treating river water and lake water. So that's A. So who's responsible there? Secondly, now we've got this bigger problem. We have an emergency manager involved with the state. We see a bigger problem. So let's start with the blame game, but someone's accountable here. What are you finding as you investigate?
Right. So Flint, like all cities in Michigan, we are in the Great Lakes state. We have access to some of the most abundant freshwater resources on the face of the earth. Our problems aren't scarcity. Our problems, if we have problems, they are man-made. You know, by the time this water got to people's taps, it was toxic. And there were active decisions that made that happen. There are a lot of unresolved questions about who precisely was to blame for each of these decisions. Who's accountable? Most folks look to the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality for a lot of this. They're the ones who have the responsibility for enforcing the Safe Drinking Water Act, including lead levels in Flint's water. They supervised the switch to a new water source. They advised the local plant that they didn't need to be adding this corrosion control to the water. They had a different interpretation of the rules, and even when the EPA told them they were wrong, they were still kind of plugging along with the same method. Their process of corrosion control was no corrosion control for a year, and then maybe we'll see if we need it, essentially, after doing some monitoring. But time was of the essence with this, you know, like the pipes were corroding that whole time, and they were just wrong. It was a violation of federal law, and it's now being reckoned with. So a number of MDEQ officials are facing criminal charges right now. There's also a number of officials with the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services who are facing charges mostly related to the Legionnaires' disease outbreak that also happened in Flint. That's the one that resulted in deaths and is believed to be connected to the water. And there's also some emergency managers who were also indicted.
There's also a finger pointing at the EPA.
And the EPA, right. This is the big report that just came out, the Inspector General's report from the Environmental Protection Agency that was looking at why didn't the EPA intervene sooner? Why did this go on for so long before the EPA used its authority to essentially declare that this was an emergency in Flint? They didn't do that until January 2016, which coincidentally is when the national spotlight hit Flint. The report is essentially saying that the EPA did have this authority, and while it was admirable that they wanted to work cooperatively with state officials, once they realized that the law wasn't being enforced appropriately and public health was on the line, they really needed to act. There was one key official at the EPA's office in Chicago who did do a lot of independent investigation, working with residents in Flint to begin documenting the lead crisis and also show how the state's testing of the water was underestimating the lead levels that were in it. He did do an interim report. He did, you know, he played a role in bringing this crisis to light, but actual accountability measures weren't taken by the EPA. And the report is, kind of sending a signal nationwide that similar agencies need to do this sooner.
And because we had state oversight, not just the DEQ, but also the emergency manager who is then administrating city business of Flint through the governor's office, you have a connection with Governor Rick Snyder. I would imagine there's a chapter in the book about this.
Right. This has been a big question from the beginning, right? As soon as this came to light, people are like, what is the governor's role in this? What did he know? And what did he know it? With Flint, the state's role in this is especially dramatic because there was an emergency manager throughout this entire process, a series of emergency managers from the contracting with the new water department, the decision to use the Flint River as a temporary source, the continued dismissals of offers from the Detroit Water Department to connect back when there was some of these early issues showing up. All of this played out under emergency management. The local mayor and the city council did not have the power of their own offices. Flint residents didn't have the power of their own votes. It was an emergency manager connected to the governor's office and the Treasury Department that had the sole authority here this entire time. And they were insistent on sticking with this process all along. Well, emergency managers aren't water experts, of course. They're relying on the DEQ for a lot of their information that was clearly wrong. But it also begs the question of how to trace the accountability in this. You know, there's in some of these court cases that are playing out, the state's arguing that the emergency managers aren't state officials, they're local ones. You know, they're making a distinction here that, you know, that the state doesn't have accountability for them as if they were an appointee of their own, which is interesting because I feel like when emergency managers do things that the state is proud of, for example, in Detroit, they're happy to boast of their connection to that and their role in doing well. I think the biggest flaw with Michigan's emergency management system, besides being very expansive and indefinite, there's no accountability when they do wrong.